As we chanted this morning, the Buddha's words, this suffering as a noble truth must be fully understood. Such was the vision, the knowledge, the wisdom, the awareness, the light that arose in me with regard to things never heard before in this world system. Suffering is such an ordinary, everyday experience. We're all very familiar with, but very few people fully understand what is this suffering anyway. If this path is about the relief from suffering for ourselves and all beings, we first have to understand what it is. We might even say to understand it completely is to be free from it. And the freedom from suffering is the Buddha's basic message. Greed, hate, and delusion is how suffering manifests through a human. And Dogen, in a conversation with his teacher Rujing, as recorded in the Hokyoki, Rujing said, Buddhas and ancestors always teach that we must be free from greed, hate, and delusion. And Dogen asked, well, what's the way to be free from greed, hate, and delusion? And Rujing says, don't you know it's the practice you've been doing all along? When you just wholeheartedly sit and drop off body and mind, this is becoming free from the five hindrances, greed, hate, and delusion, restlessness, worry, and dull, haziness. We can be free from all of these, and all doubt as well. Just sitting and dropping off body and mind. You could say this is also clarifying what is this suffering, this noble truth of suffering. just sitting, dropping off body and mind. We understand, we fully understand what is this suffering. The pivot point is this sense of I. Doesn't it all seem to revolve around me and mine? If ever we come across some suffering, if ever we encounter greed, hate, and delusion, propose that right there, at that time, there's a sense of me and mine. Could be quite blatant, could be quite hidden, but this sense of ownership, this sense of somebody that this experience is happening to. And therefore, that's the person who suffers. I don't think it's possible for there to be suffering with no person there experiencing it. No sense of the one who is suffering. They go together. So part of this fully understanding this noble truth of suffering is seeing that suffering is the creation of an illusory self, where there isn't one, where there's just the experience happening. Painful or pleasant experience happening. No particular problem. But if it's my painful experience, then we have a problem. I have a problem. That's who has a problem. So this all goes together. Fully understanding that what we call suffering in this world is the creation of an illusory sense of independent self, the doer, the owner, the controller, the experiencer. And that just wholeheartedly sitting we let go of the I maker, the I making. Dropping off body and mind is simply dropping off my body and mind. And there can be a body and mind with no owner. And this is the way to be free from greed, hate, delusion, even restlessness and lethargy and doubt. So deeply investigating the connection between the sense of some core identity of me-ness and suffering, clarifying this connection again and again, we can start to unravel the mess. The understanding of no independent self, anatman, in the foundational teachings can also be called emptiness, shunyata, in the Mahayana teachings, the second turning of the Dharma wheel can be called Buddha nature, Cittagadagarbha, in the third turning of the Dharma wheel. It can be called ordinary mind, or our original face before our parents were born, in the Zen family style. It all comes down to the same point. We have many great ancestors who encourage us to understand suffering and drop off body and mind. So yesterday I started bringing up the story of Kodo Sawaki Roshi, born about 1880, died in the 1960s. And yesterday I mentioned how he, for those who weren't here yesterday, Kodo Sawaki Roshi is one of the great Soto Zen ancestors in recent times in Japan, the teacher of Uchiyama Roshi, now Okamura Roshi in America, is in Kodo Sawaki's lineage, and Koben Chino Roshi, our founder, practiced briefly with Kodo Sawaki Roshi when he was young. So in his youth, both of Sawaki's parents died when I think he was six and eight. His mother and father both died, and he kept getting passed around to different relatives, and who were not very kind to him. And mostly he was living for a while with these adopted parents, who were his foster father was a gambler and alcoholic, and so we're to the point where he continued living with these adopted parents, selling pounded rice cakes to help support them while they gambled and drank their lives away. He's still maybe about 8 years old or so, maybe a little older now. And he saw other people die too at this age, up close. And it took him a while for it to sink in, but at some point the fact of impermanence hit him. The fact of his own mortality and the fleetingness of this life. Somewhere along the way, he met a Jodo Shinshu priest, this Pure Land Buddhist priest, and heard some talks and heard about the Buddha's way. Dharma talks had a great impression on him, and his home life was so difficult that he got a stronger and stronger resolve to leave home, quite literally. I kept thinking, I want to be a monk. I want to be a monk. I didn't care if I died in the process. I got to get out of here, and here's a response. So he went to talk to this Jodo Shinshu priest, and he said, well, if you want to be a monk, don't become a Jodo Shinshu priest like me. My life is very complicated. I have 5 children. My wife is dead. And, in Jodo Shinshu, we're supposed to, the doctrine is to set the example of family life, quite interestingly, in Japan. Jodo Shinshu priests are expected to get married and have family. But the Zen monks aren't expected to. So if you want to have a simpler life, just be a Zen monk. And so Kodo Suwaki immediately set out for Eheiji, the headquarters of the Soto school in Japan, the Vatican of Soto Zen. And he says, this is in his own story, he says, I didn't have any particular reason to choose Eheiji, he recalled, other than it was far enough away so my parents wouldn't be able to bring me back, and because the Shin priest advised me to become a Zen monk. Eheiji is the most well-known Zen monastery. I guess I'll go there. He didn't research it. This was before they had websites. And it was apparently a long way away. There were plenty of Zen temples nearby, probably. He said it was a place I hadn't heard of. But maybe Tsu City in Mie Prefecture. Mie? Is it on the main island? Because I wondered, when he says how long it takes, I wondered if he was on... Actually, it sounds like maybe it's on some other island, because Eheiji's on Honshu, the main island. And he then set off from home with a lantern and the clothes on his back. He was quite poor, but that's all he brought. On his way out of town, he visited the Jodo Shin priest, who was his friend, and that priest gave him 3.5 liters of rice and a small amount of money to help him on his journey, which he spent on ferry fares, which makes me think it must have been a different island. Stamps to send cards informing his family of his decision to leave after he left, and roasted soybeans to eat on the way. After 4 days on ferries and on foot, spending nights in small shrines built for religious pilgrims, he arrived at Eheiji. His joy was quickly tempered when he was refused entry to the monastery. After 4 days of not knowing what would happen, of course, when he got there. And it's quite typical to be refused entry at a place like that.
He'd be
9. Yeah, I think he's... maybe he's a teenager now. Yeah, because he stays at Eheiji for a little while, and when he leaves, he's 18. So he says himself, finally, I arrived at Eheiji, explaining my situation, and asked to be ordained. But they clearly weren't going to accept me. I was told unconditionally to go home, my plea falling on deaf ears. "I can't go back home," I said. "I'm famished. I can't move. Let me just die here." "Well, we'll let you have some leftover rice gruel. Go home as soon as you've finished," was the response I got. Then I said, "Then don't bother feeding me." And I continued making my plea for 2 days and nights without eating or drinking. Finally, a priest named Jikizo, the person in charge of building and repairs, the administrator, observed my condition and couldn't remain indifferent. He asked me to come to his place and invited me in, letting me stay in the workers' room with the other workers for the time being. He managed to get me into the temple. So it was kind of like maybe a workshop on the sort of outside. It wasn't the monks, but it was the kind of hired workers. I will never in my life forget the feeling of joy I had after all I had endured when I was allowed to stay with these servant workers. I couldn't help shedding tears of gratitude, and each and every monk I met appeared to be a bodhisattva. At that time, I was wearing an unlined striped kimono, my only clothes. The master of Hakuju Hermitage, a hermitage in front of Eheji's main gate, where I think it's the place where people going to stay there go and stay the first night. He gathered torn robes thrown away by practitioners, and sewing them together made monk's robes for me. He put them on me, and somehow I looked a little like a monk. I was so moved and joyful that tears streamed down my face. So sincere. He just wants to practice. He doesn't even really know what practice is yet, right? But he just wants to start a new life. His life's been just a difficult time. And he has some faith in this Buddha way. And they're giving him kind of a hard time at the Buddhist temple, but somebody's a little bit kind and moves him so greatly. He stayed on with the workers for a while, but he wasn't allowed to be ordained. And I think this is still true at Eheji, in particular, these big head monasteries. You have to be ordained priest to actually go practice there already. They don't, you know, it's kind of just a training place for people coming in from other small places. So he had to find a teacher in some other temple who would accept him as a disciple. He went to other temples only to be used by lazy priests looking for disciples to legitimize their positions and relieve them of part of their own workload. "Sure, you can stay here and practice with me. Here's the work list." Frustrated, he returned to Eheji, where he was befriended by a monk named Koun Yamamoto. Koun recognized his seriousness and recommended he go to Japan's western island of Kyushu and study with Koun's teacher, Koho Sawada. So it sounded like maybe he never actually like really got into practice at Eheji. He was kind of hanging out in the worker's place, going back and forth, looking for other places, not really working out. But at least now he has this friend who says, here's someone you can go practice with, but it's a long way to Kyushu from Eheji. So he set out with no money or supplies. His battered monk's robes allowed him to spend nights at temples on the way, and he was usually sent off the next day with a box lunch. Maybe he still wasn't even ordained, but he could get away with staying at temples along the way. The trip was arduous, leading through mountain passes in midwinter, and he suffered from severe frostbite of the feet, among other things. At that point, he realized he couldn't continue all the way to Kyushu, and he took refuge in his sister's home in Ueno in Iga province. His sister, yeah. So he had several other siblings, and when his parents died, they were all sent out to different families because nobody could take on a bunch of kids. So they were all separated, but I guess they stayed in touch. And maybe his sister's house happened to be along the way when his feet got too frostbitten to continue. She was the wife of the proprietor of a fish shop. She attended to his injuries, but only after taking him outside and stripping off all his dirty clothes, and he was completely full of lice. And he realized there must have been quite a commotion when he left all the temples that he'd stayed at along the way and left lice on all the beds. And he felt really bad about that. His brother-in-law, seeing him in tattered robes, lice-ridden and frostbitten, tried to persuade him to give up his dream of being a monk and settle with them as a fishmonger. So Waki thanked him, but when his wounds healed, he set out once again for Kyushu. So determined. He was very blessed to, at a young age, become disillusioned with the samsaric world, become disenchanted with birth and death. The rest of the trip didn't go much better. He says, I boarded a ferry near Kobe. There was a big fuss when one of the passengers lost 3 yen, which is like a few cents, right? Maybe in those days it was a dollar or something, $5 or whatever. Being the most ragged-looking passenger, I was suspect. I would never do anything wrong, I protested. I'm on my way to Kyushu from Aheiji for religious practice. I'm poor, but I wouldn't steal even if my life depended on it. But no one believed me. I was put in jail for a month. Can you believe it?
Like, this is like Oliver Twist.
Yes.
It's a hard knock life. That's a little man.
It's a hard knock life. His resolve is being tested again and again. But he did get to learn about life in prison, which would help him many years later when he was asked to give Dharma talk to prisoners. During his incarceration, the other prisoners laughed at him when they found out he was in jail for something as minor as stealing, and they laughed even louder when he denied doing it. Eventually, he made it to Kyushu, to this temple, Shoshinji, 11 months after leaving Aheiji. Almost a year after he left. I mean, we don't know how long he was at his sister's and what else was happening along the way. It was 1897. He left on Rohatsu, December 8th, 1897, and arrived almost a year later. He was 18 years old when he arrived. The stories get more interesting. You have to come back for more. Here's some teachings from Kodo Suwaki. This is a little collection someone translated and put on the internet called To You, Sayings of Kodo Suwaki Roshi. To you, and it has these little different sections. So the first section is, to you who can't stop worrying about how others see you. That's this section. It already begins in school, giving exams, passing out grades, grouping and scoring people according to their work, How foolish. What does important and unimportant mean? Is it important to have a good memory? Is someone who has a bad memory a bad person? Aren't there lots of idiots with good memories? And some who end up at the bottom of their class live out their lives feeling like victims. They say their lives have been all screwed up, and it's precisely this attitude that screws up their lives. Feeling like you have to get the good grades, right? So, to you who worry about what others think of you, don't be happy about the grades others give you. Take responsibility for yourself. You're happy or you're upset when others praise or criticize you, but you don't even understand yourself. Those eight winds of the world push us hither and thither. Praise and blame, gain and loss, pain and pleasure, fame and disrepute. Basically, what others think of us. Of course, that's what we get caught up in, because of the one who's the owner of our experience. That one feels hurt or diminished. There's just the experience, the conditioned experience that's happening, whether it remembers something or not, whether it gets a good grade or not, it's fine. But the system of grading almost like promotes the I-making. It supports the I-making. I mean, I didn't do so well. It's hard not to fall into that. Even here at Santa Cruz Zen Center, the head teacher gets an evaluation. He gets ranked in various categories about his performance. And I got a mix of good and bad grades this year. Oh, thank you. Oh, I feel so good. I have a good memory. It's just that I can't give very good Dharma talks, apparently. Please excuse me. It's confession time. I got a low grade on Dharma talks, I'll let you know. And you know, it moved me. I was slightly dejected, I must say. Right? Well, it was a great teaching for me. I appreciate that Dharma gift of the evaluation. Not so much to know what I'm good and bad at, but to see how the winds of the world push me. Very helpful. Someone barely. I'm still here. I'm leaning a little bit in the wind. But, you know, the winds come from the other side. I'm blowing back. Yes?
Since we seem to be at sort of a loose juncture here, I was watching the show about happiness on KTV. You know, and it kept coming back to people who live simple lives. And as you're telling the story, I thought, if he had gone ahead and lived the simple life of a fishmonger,
mm-hmm,
and kept it simple, he had kind of a head for not getting, you know, for what the world could be. the simple, clean life. I'm not so sure he couldn't have been just as happy as
could be.
Followed.
Yeah. Could be. There are many happy fishmongers.
I think so.
I hope so.
I do too.
It may be that for little Sawaki, it may be that at that point in his life, he felt like he couldn't rely on adults anymore. Maybe was part of it, you know. He had so much trouble with these foster parents, and kind of like, you can come, well, you know, I don't know how much older they were. It was his sister and her husband. So, but maybe like, maybe he'd become so disillusioned with just, you know, everybody that he'd come across with, that he had this very independent spirit. So you could just say, well, why even go to a monastery? Then you're going to be pushed around by seniors anyway. But maybe he felt like it would be different than trying to get by in the usual world. Something about his, he just seen so much trouble. So maybe later he could have gone back. And in fact, later he became a school professor at a Buddhist university. So he wasn't always living in monastery.
Well, there is the question about practice. I mean, if you live in a simple area and a simple part of the country and do simple, clean work,
yeah,
is it necessary to practice, or have you already set up an uncomplicated enough life that?
Well, it may be pretty good, but you know, to really be free from suffering, then at least the Buddha says, this noble truth of suffering must be fully understood. So, whatever practice helps us fully understand what is this suffering. And it may be that it doesn't necessarily have to be Buddha Dharma. And simple life, simplicity helps us to not get too caught up in the things that just don't give us enough time to ask, what is this suffering? I don't have time to check that out now because I have to keep suffering. I don't have time to ask what it is. I'm busy, too busy suffering. So some kind of understanding has to arise. And, you know, some of us may be denser than others, so we have to really get really quiet and look for a long time to really see this. You'll be amazed at some of what Kodo Sawaki felt he had to do himself to understand this suffering. He says, I've never praised anyone. It's kind of interesting. But, so this is this section about, you know, those who worry what people think of you. I've never praised anyone. That sounds kind of strange. Everyone already knows their strengths, and they even usually see them as stronger than they really are. I don't know about that. You know, I think there's room for praise in this world. That was Kodo's style. Maybe he'd never really been praised himself and felt like we don't need to boost each other up or push each other down. Let's just live together. Yeah.
I studied early childhood education, and it's a very important teaching that if you praise a child, they're always looking over their shoulder to see if it's good
enough. Oh, interesting.
But at the same time, if they do something that's, you know, not so good, you don't blame them.
Can you praise a good action?
Well, what you would do is you can recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of a praise, you know, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you might just recognize using words to describe what happened so that the child understands.
Mm-hmm. Like we might say, oh, you know, when you gave the ball to your friend Johnny, did you see how happy he was?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it makes me happy too. Maybe that's too much. Yeah. Interesting. You're good. Yeah. Is a little extra. Because that's the self, then.
Yes.
Now it's like, not so much what I do, but like my essential owner of my experience is good or bad. But that's the thing, yeah, I think Ellen's saying even to say that activity was good is maybe too general, huh?
You don't use good and bad.
You don't use good and bad. They're too generic.
But what you said was perfect, showing that by your doing this, your friend is looking at his face.
Yeah.
And
cause and effect.
Through the opposite, when a child would bite another child, look at your friend. He's crying.
Yeah.
You know, that hurt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I remember in elementary school I had this wonderful teacher, one of those favorite teachers from growing up, who was, I think, unusual. Maybe a little bit radical. And I think he really cared about me a lot. And I still remember this one time in class, maybe some of the kids were fighting, and he was trying to find some skillful means to help. And my memory of it was something like he gathered all the kids around, and then he faced me and said, you know, you're really a jerk. And I just like totally, almost like I was a very sensitive little kid. I just totally deflated. And just immediately, I don't know if I started crying even or something, you know, it was so painful. And then immediately he said, you know, oh, not really, you know. I'm just showing this example. And he said to all the other kids, did you see what happened to this little boy when I said that? Yeah, so I was like the guinea pig. I was like the one he sort of used. And I don't know why he chose me. But he thought, well, maybe it'll be okay. Or maybe he's so sensitive that maybe he'll be a great example. He won't fight back. I'm just like, no! but it had a big impact, and I still remember it. And I knew he loved me. I knew it wasn't really, you know. Immediately he said, this is just to help everybody learn about how being mean creates this effect. Yes.
It could be a cultural thing too, in Asian cultures more, in terms of their child rearing. Because you know how when the Dalai Lama was so shocked that Westerners kind of as a whole seem to be have a very low self-esteem.
Yeah.
Themselves.
Yeah.
And it's like it didn't compute for a while. Like it was such a foreign concept. So there must be, I'm guessing there's just something that's a different.
Yeah. I mean, I wonder, because little Sawaki, you know, didn't have much, sounds like he didn't have much love and care from his foster parents. And yet, he also doesn't seem to have low self-esteem. Right? So, who knows his karmic situation. But, yeah, maybe it's just in a culture where everyone's taught to be quite independent and kind of like step into society at a quite young age and take up your duties Maybe.
Well, he had his parents up to five and nine, I think. They're the crucial years.
So, yeah, yeah.
And also he became a professor at school, so he obviously had some sharpness of mind.
Yeah, uh-huh. That's true. And it sounded like his original parents were actually very kind. And so maybe that was in those crucial years, his sense of self-worth was created, and then he could get tossed around later. And I think, he was known to be a very, strong-minded, stubborn character his whole life, so that was, I think, part of it. I mean, just trying to get to this place seems very stubborn, right? It's like, well, sure, I'll just stop and be a fishmonger with you all. He could have done, but he's like, no, I decided what I'm going to do, and I'm carrying through. My frostbite's better enough to walk now. So we can continue gathering the mind into the presence of this moment, relaxed and alert and present, settled enough to start examining what is this suffering, if by chance any suffering might arise today, any slight aversion for what's happening. What exactly is it? And particularly, maybe enough to just investigate what it is, but if we want a little clue to work with there, it's like, check out this sense of the owner of the experience. I think that the one who it's happening to, the sense that there's some me here that this experience is happening to, is a key ingredient in the problem of suffering. May our intention equally extend to every being and place, that all may realize Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable.